opening up with a very sensitive but important topic in our community, and that's the notion of substance abuse. And one of the things I mentioned yesterday in Shul, one of the things I love that is so beautiful about our Torah is the Torah never hides the unpleasantries of life, never hides the faults of our great, great leaders. And we have right in the Chumash, the beginning of the Chumash, Noach, who's described as a tzaddik, a righteous person. The Torah tells us he got drunk. It happens in the best of families, in the best of on the best of people. And what we're hoping here tonight is really to discuss the issue of nipping the problem before it becomes a problem. Of notions how we can talk to our children before it becomes a problem. How to recognize the signs so it will not become a problem. I am the first to admit I really have absolutely no expertise in this area, and that's why after this I'll be quiet for the rest of the evening. But we have put together, I believe, a panel of people who are well experienced and have a lot to add. And hopefully it'll be an evening, really a beginning of a discussion and an ongoing type of a discussion in our community. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Marla Goldman, who's the executive director of JAX, which has been dealing with the problem on much more of a professional level, a support group to help people who may have issues. So I'll turn over the microphone to her auspices.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the program of protecting our children in today's world. And to begin, I want to thank Rabbi and Rabbitson Jay Kelman for taking the time with Zalman and I working so diligently to try and bring this program and put it together. Just to let you know a little bit about JAX, I am, like you said, the executive director of JAX. JAX stands for Jewish Alcoholics, Chemical Dependencies, and Significant Others. I'm sure you saw our signs all over Toronto. We have one at Bathurst and Centre. We have one at the Jewish Council of Women, which says on the top, JAX, alcoholic, drug addict, family member, and confidential helpline, 416-410-JAX. Surprising enough, I want to share with you that our JAX phone line takes between 130 and 200 calls a month from Jewish families with problems with addiction. We have a center at 858 Shepherd Avenue West, where we have approximately 700 people that go through our center a month who have problems with addiction. So I'm glad that finally we're opening up the topic and sharing with the Jewish community. We have a problem. Our children are using drugs. We have children at risk. We have children going through the court system. And tonight what we're going to do is share some of our stories with you, our experience, our strength and hope, and hopefully educate you a little bit about addiction and what goes on in the Jewish community. So to begin, because Jay put me on a strict time limit, I want to introduce to you my first speaker. He's a father, and his name is Gordon Hayward. And over the last few months, Gordon and I have built a relationship, and he's been coming to JAX. On Thursday nights, I run a meeting that is for the addict, the alcoholic, and the family member, where we have anywhere between 30 and 50 people come and attend just this meeting to find out information. So on that note, I'll let Gordon let you know how he met me. And please welcome Gordon Hayward.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me say right away, I don't know what other people's expectations of a turnout would be, but this is one of the largest turnouts I have ever seen, because the odd empty seats that are here, 15 years ago there would have been two empty seats that my wife and I would not have been in because we didn't think we had a problem. So I guess I haven't spoken in a long time, and I'm a little nervous, so please bear with me. About 15 years ago, my son went to a rock concert down at the old exhibition stadium to see the Pink Floyd. And he went with a good friend of his from the school, and he never returned home. So I was looking for a missing child almost the entire weekend, and it came to light late on a Sunday night that drugs might be involved. And I had no idea, absolutely no idea that that would be the farthest thing from my mind. I was arguing with the police, saying they weren't doing enough. I finally had to turn to an acquaintance from the Toronto Sun, Paul Godfrey, and I phoned him at home because I knew his home phone number. And I told him that my son had disappeared and I'm looking for him and I was getting nowhere with the police. So he told me that, I said, and it looks like drugs are involved. So he got me some help with the police. They jumped pretty high when Paul called them, but he told me, he said, look, he says, if I put this thing in the paper, he said, people are going to know all about it and your son might come home. So he told me, like, you have till 10:30 at night to stop the out-of-town papers and 11:30 at night to stop the city papers. He said he would run a little story if he didn't come home, and he said, and then from there on, he says, the radio stations, the television people will be calling you. And he said, can you handle that? And I said, look, I said, I'm not a movie star, and I'm not a politician. And I said, I want my son back if there's any chance. And he said, okay. Anyway, needless to say, he ran with both the stories. And he disappeared on a Friday. We found him on a Wednesday in the lake. I won't go into all of the things there, but I was then faced with the reality that there was going to be an inquest. And I didn't know what to do. I did speak to my rabbi because I was torn. Half of me, the old cabbage town half, if you will, wanted to stand up and do something about it because, you know, my son was 14 and I really wanted to make a difference. My employers and many of our good friends well-meaningly said, don't say a word, let it be. It's not going to make a difference. I couldn't do it. So torn, I went to my rabbi and I said, Philip, I said, I'm really torn on what to do. Half of me wants to do something, the other half doesn't. And so he told me a little story, which I'll share with you. I won't keep this too long. He said that there are tears of smoke and tears of fruitfulness. Tears of the smoke just go up in the air and dissipate, just like a cigarette that, you know, you don't even know you smoked. He says, then there are tears that fall to the ground, hopefully nourish something, and something good comes from it. He says, and the tears that you're crying, you have to decide which way they're going to fall. So with that, I just said, you know, you threw it back at me. And he says, I'm a rabbi. That's what I'm supposed to do. You're supposed to make up your mind. So we went to the inquest. Some friends helped. But there was nothing in the Jewish community. And I say that nothing that I was aware of, if there was. People thought this, you know, we're not shikkers. We don't beat our wives. We don't have incest. We don't drink. We don't, all of the things that we don't do, which we do do. And, which I, you know, the places we could go where I'd be speaking when I did speak would be with my wife in a church. That was the only place to go, or a service club. Mostly the Jewish community didn't want anything to do with it. The odd time when we spoke to people in the Jewish community, it would be in someone's home where there was some concern. And that went on for a while, but I was really disappointed that the Jewish community wasn't getting out and saying what the problem was. I was a little angry with the Jewish news, so here we went to a Gentile organization who we became some speakers, and my main interest was education, getting it down to, I wanted kindergarten, but most people said, oh, you can't tell them at kindergarten. Tell them at 14. I said, my son was 14. I said, what are you going to tell them at 14? Maybe he should be, or someone 14 could be standing up here teaching the class. So I wasn't interested in someone my age, some of the ages of the young people here. I wanted to get the little kids first, because when my son could tell me, Dad, you know, smoking gives you emphysema, heart disease, hardening of the arteries, lung cancer, gono. I knew all that, but I didn't know anything about drugs. I really didn't know anything about it. And obviously he didn't know too much because he bought LSD for $2. And people at the rock concert gave him free hashish and marijuana. And as I say, Benji fell in the lake. Maybe he thought he could walk on water. I don't know. And we found the other boy just in jeans and socks. And luckily he was alive. But I guess the big point that I'm trying to say, I'd like to say, I really like it that there are young people here, because they could probably tell you a lot of stories that they've heard, but kids all like to stick together and they don't like to say too much about it to their friends. And I do feel that the biggest times for drug use is really between 4 and 6, when they come home from school and before the parents get home. That's when, from my experience, that's when you have to watch for it. But more importantly, there's a place now called Jack's, and when I heard about this, I read it in the Jewish news, and I said, finally, they're saying something. Though I must say, I started to read in the Jewish news in the last couple of years that the Orthodox community was talking and speaking out more and more, which was good. And they were, you know, like for shelters for battered wives. My sister was a battered woman, and I used to help out with the only place I knew was the Emily Stowe shelter for battered women. And and I thought, you know, gee, if people in the Jewish community, where do they go? If it's such a small community and they're religious and something's going wrong, you can't take a person and put them in Scarborough or put them out in Mississauga. That's not their community. We need something for the Jewish community. And Jack's is, well, I got a hold of Marla through the Jewish news and just said it's wonderful that, I don't know, everything I talk about is after the barn door is closed, but there are people that have a place to go that have a problem if they want to go. They're the only ones that can go. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. If people want to go, there is now a place where people are talking about it. It's a great thing. I've gone, and I've listened to some very sad stories. And, you know, like I didn't have a chance. I found out at the inquest that while our police department is excellent, they said at the inquest that they had stopped my son and this same boy just 6 weeks prior to his death, buying drugs downtown on Yonge Street to take back up here. And they just, because he was articulate, well-spoken, well-mannered, well-dressed, educated, they just decided to throw the stuff down the sewer and not say a word. I think if they'd have told me that or marched him home like they did to me when I was a kid in Cabbage Town, they would come home and say, Mrs. Hayward, your kid just stole this chocolate bar, blah, 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 whatever. Maybe that straightened me out. I would have had a chance. I don't know what I would have done with the chance or how it would have helped, but I would have been given the opportunity to do something. And as I say, for the community, if there's a problem, there's a place to phone, to go in comfort and privacy, and it's Jack's. And I don't know if there's much more I can say. I'm impressed with the amount of people here now because... I really am. And I mean that. I'm not just saying that. It's true because there were an awful lot of empty seats 15 years ago and no Jewish venue, only in someone's house. I mean, I could go on about the inquest, which I had to take part in. A lot of people in the Jewish community, friends, did help out with the funding so that we could get standing so it wouldn't be a whitewash. I just felt, wherever the chips fall, we're going to have to blow the lid off of whatever we can to help people. You know, and people fight with they say we need money for the police department. We need money for education. We need money for rehabilitation. Well, you know, you have a camera, and the camera stands on a tripod. If you remove one leg of the camera, it falls over. So I really want education to the little ones so that they know and they can choose to do with that education that which they want. And the younger, the better. And then, of course, enforcement and certainly rehabilitation. And all three units have to pull together. Because, as I said many years ago, it's not black, it's not white, it's not Jewish, it's not Catholic. Everybody's got this problem. And the more that... Not that the Jewish community has money, per se. They have influence and could do an awful lot more, which they are doing now, because the kids are at risk. And I really think that they need a lot of help. And there is a place for the families to go. That's why I hate to use the word thrilled, but, you know, that there is a place for people to go. I mean, I went after 15 years just sitting down and listening to people and say, geez, If my son were alive and I had the problem, here are people that I can talk to that can give me some guidance, some place that I could go and maybe help out. In the end, it's really up to God and to the person, whether he's an alcoholic or... At my end, I mean, I'm interested in kids, and I mean, I'm glad to see a little boy 13. I asked him how old he was. You know, Ben was only a year older, but it's good to see young people here and... I don't know how long they want me to go on here talking, but It's the first time I've spoken in a long time. And parents, if you have a problem, know you have a problem, there is a place to go. It's not going to solve all your problems. It's going to help you, give you guidance, tell you where you can go to get professional help, and listen to you. They will listen. You can tell your story, and nothing goes outside those doors. It's private, whereas before you couldn't tell anybody or didn't want to tell anybody. It wasn't a shunned. Everybody was ashamed. Well, you can't. You got to get it on the table, get it out, and really do something about it, because when a policeman comes to your door and says, you know, we found your son in the lake, in my case, I knew they were looking and everything like that. And then you have to go to the morgue and identify someone. You know, it's not like Law and Order. They don't whip off the sheet anymore and just say, you know, and people get shocked and that's it. They do it on a television. It's very, very antiseptic. It's on a television set. And they say to you, well, he said to me, Mr. Hayward, just when you see this, just say the last name first and then the first name. And I don't know how I managed to do that, because when the television came on and there was my son, I don't know how I said Hayward, Benjamin. No question. And then it was clicked off, and then they told me that they were going to do an autopsy. I jumped up and down. I didn't want that. I said, I think I know what's happened. They said, no, the public needs it now. He's part of the public domain. You have no choice. And if there was anybody that I could help that wouldn't have to go through that, and people that are taking drugs, you know, your parents may wind up having to identify you. And I can't change anybody. I can only talk about my experience. And it's the worst thing that ever happened. My wife and I joined the Council on Drug Abuse. That was the only thing out there at the time. There was no JACs. And we did do some speaking. But as I was just saying to someone earlier, I said, you know who'd love to get a hold of Jewish alcoholics and drug addicts? Jews for Jesus. What they could do, just dragging those people in. You've already got somebody that's got a problem. They could really pick their brain and, well, anyway. Look, I think I've talked long enough, and there are better educated people here that will be able to help you out. So thank you very much for listening.
Thanks, Gordon. And, you know, it's funny, through what Gordon's been through, losing a son is a difficult thing, but the greatest gift that he has today is he's giving back to the Jewish community by sharing his experience with us, that we can learn and grow. And Gordon's been coming, like I said, Thursday night to help me with the meetings. At JACS, I don't work alone. I work together with someone who heads our, is the Director of Religious Development and Programming, and I'd like to introduce you, Zelman Goldman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you for coming. Gordon, I'll tell you that in the 8 years that I was in the Ner Yisrael system, Rabbi Friedler, who was the dean at Ner Yisrael, which is a local yeshiva, before Ni'ilan, Yom Kippur, I don't think I ever shared this with you, got up and he cried for 20 minutes, sharing what had happened. And in the 8 years in the system, it was the only time that the word drugs were ever mentioned. So, when I think back now, over 15 years and the impact and getting to know you, we're really very grateful that you came out tonight. My involvement in JACS, I worked for NCSY for 7 years, and then I spent 3 years with our Sameach. And over the course of the years, I saw kids that had become teenagers and then university students. And as they got into trouble, we ultimately worked out a deal with the police and with the courts where they would come and do their community service with us at JEP. And it went from a once or twice a year to a regular thing where we were getting regular calls, and came to a point where there was a particular crisis. And I called an old friend of mine, the founder of JACS Canada in Ottawa, and he put me on to Neville Smith, who's here with us tonight, the founding chairman of JACS. Just to recognize Neville, thank you for coming. And thank you for putting this all together. And the involvement went further and further. I became, I guess, a liaison to a certain element in the community where I would get regular calls from day school principals, rabbanim, and time again, it would be a unique story that I was hearing over and over again. And in our community, there are some very special people that have put years and in some cases decades into helping people, into understanding, into not judging anyone, but looking at the problem as it is and being able to really keep a lot of these people alive, put them back on their feet. I tell people in JAX, we see doctors, lawyers, CEOs, and then there's always one or two of your typical vision of the kid with smack in the gutter somewhere. But the average person that we see is, you know, could be sitting here in this room tonight. So I wanted to take a moment and just introduce you to one of those special people who's helped us over the years, and I'd like to introduce Jay.
It's too tall for me. Okay. Hi, my name's Jay Pasternak. I'm a counselor, and I want to just thank the JAX, all the people at JAX, for asking me to speak for a few minutes tonight. It's a real pleasure and honor to address the Jewish community in any way that I can, because as I look at Rabbi Kelman, I get choked up. I'm going to cry. I know. you have to bear with me. Yeah, they did my bar mitzvah. Right, I did a great job. Okay, I do a lot of clinical work. I'm a counselor in a hospital. I work at Humber River Regional Hospital. I've been there for about 6 or 7 years. Prior to that, for about 7 years, I worked with the Donwood, and we developed a youth outreach program. We helped kids stay in school a little bit longer when they would have been kind of bounced out or gone off to a treatment center. So I think at one time we had 80 schools doing support groups, and a number of them continue to do that. As well, I work for a company called Alcohol and Drug Concerns, and we do jail programs. So we go into the jail systems, and we do different types of substance abuse counseling. And we also developed a program that we have 20 or 30 peers every year that we train to go out to speak to grade 7 and 8s. So I'm involved in a lot of different types of work. I also have a small private practice, and I see people privately. But what I really wanted to talk about, why Marla asked me, was probably prior to 15 years ago, my life wasn't that great. And, you know, I got caught up in drugs and alcohol in high school. Most kids have to make that decision at some point along the line, you know, where they stand with drugs and alcohol. And experimental use is pretty commonplace. It's probably about 80% now by the time they walk out of high school. And for some kids, you know, dealing with the emotional strain of facing adulthood, coming out of adolescence, going through their teens, going into adulthood, it's for some it's very traumatic, and it's a lot more overwhelming than parents may feel it is, especially in today's day and age with all the information that we have at our disposal and all the resources that are out there as far as drugs and alcohol goes. You know, it's far different today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. 20 or 30 years ago, a joint was a joint. You can smoke a joint, and that's it. You could go back to class an hour later. Today, dope's a lot stronger than it was. There is a significant buildup of THC in the system. Back when I was in school, it just, you know, was it just seemed to me that the party always continued. You know, if we partied on the weekend, we brought it into a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And for me and some of my friends, we just kind of continued on with the party. We kind of put school off to the side and kept partying and partying. And really, for me, by the time I got out of high school, I was really functionally illiterate. I couldn't deal with life on life's terms at all. You know, I could read, I could go to school, as far as reading and writing, things like that goes, but emotionally I was illiterate. I couldn't deal with my own feelings. And that carried on right through my early 20s, I guess, until, you know, drug dealing became a way of life for me. And we always say either deal or steal. Nobody rides for free. And basically that's what was happening. And, you know, I see some parents nodding their heads. And I got arrested down in New York State and facing years and years in jail. I came back to Canada on a prisoner transfer. And actually Rabbi Kelman was the one who... I don't even know if you know this. You probably do, though, right? there was nowhere, no treatment center in Canada would take me because I had these criminal charges outstanding in the States. And through him, I got into a hospital here. And that was the start of my journey. Although it took, you know, a lot of years, I went to prison for a number of years and came out of jail and went back to using, because although the hospital tried what they could. Back then, addiction wasn't, you know, alcoholism was a big problem, drug addiction wasn't. So they really didn't know how to treat drug addiction. That was part of it. The other side was, really, I didn't want it. Facing jail time, facing a demise of my family, facing everything else, I really just didn't want it. I didn't want it at that time. I went to prison, I got out, and although I wanted it at that time, I didn't have the tools. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to live clean and sober. And it took about 6 months to a year, and I went back to using. And I realized at one point, I think my mother turned around to me and she said, if you're doing drugs again, you deserve to go back to jail. And we won't be there to bail you out this time. And I don't know, for some reason, I looked at myself in the mirror. My girlfriend said to me the same thing. She said, if you're doing drugs, don't call me, don't fax me, don't write me. Go home, think about what you're doing. And that night I went to a self-help group. I went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Could have been a Cocaine Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was a self-help group, which, you know, this is what Jax promotes. It promotes a lot of self-help involvement. And I went, and for the first time, I kind of felt like people knew what I was talking about. You know, it wasn't from a psychiatric point of view. It wasn't from a mental health point of view. It wasn't from a social work point of view. It was just one addict helping another addict. And, you know, and I saw people there that I'd grown up with in this community. You know, and the thing was that they had 3 or 4 months clean and sober. And I thought to myself, there's no way on earth these guys could get 3 months clean and sober. They're like me. They're daily users, except they haven't gotten caught, right? So, and I looked at them, and I saw one thing in their eyes that I never saw in my eyes, and that was hope. Whenever I looked in the mirror, I never saw hope in my eyes. And what I saw in these people was their eyes were bright and shining, and they were living life. They were living life on life's terms, which I hadn't been for a long time. So, you know, I went to meetings religiously, I guess. I went back to my roots and back to Jack's and attending some other kind of spiritual involvement anyway. And now I give back to the community. I went back to school. I went to McMaster University. I went to George Brown College. I have 2 beautiful kids. I have a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, it blows me away every time I think about where my life is today. I have the respect of my family, the community. I'm asked to speak in all types of venues. They fly me all over Ontario. I think I've spoken to 27,000 hydro workers at one point. At one point, we were doing about 225 class presentations. Public health gives me a whole chunk of money every year to go out to the schools and train other kids. So it's, you know, the journey's been amazing. I wish it wasn't the vehicle that I had to take to get here. You know, that's the one thing I don't like. But the journey's been amazing, and again, it's been such a rewarding life in this last, especially the last kind of 8 or 9 years since my kids have been born. It's just been amazing. I forever have a debt of gratitude to Rabbi Kelman for that phone call. I don't know what happened, but I went from can't get into anywhere to get into a hospital for 6 months. So it was, you know, it was one call that just kind of, you know, turned my life around.
And thanks, Jay, because that was a surprise for Jay tonight. Before I go on to the next one of the questions I'm always asked is people ask me is, how do you know whether you're an addict alcoholic and what does one look like? You know, so I remember when Jax first started way back 3 years ago, it was November 27th, we had our first night at the Associated Hebrew School. I was the main speaker and I stood up and I said, hi, I want everyone to have a good look at me. By looking at me, can you tell anything about me? Can you tell, am I reformed? Am I conservative? Am I orthodox? What kind of family did I come from? And I said the same thing. Look at your neighbor next to you, and by looking at your neighbor sitting beside you, can you tell who they are, where they came from, what they feel, what's going on inside? Because the other part that I'd like to share with you before I go on and introduce our next speaker is, hi, my name is Marla Goldman. I am the executive director of JAX, but I am an addict alcoholic. And last May 3rd, I celebrated 10 years clean and sober. And the part why I like to share it, because, you know, when I see Jay speak, you know, it makes me smile because it lets you know that here's two Jewish people. And I'll let you know, I was brought up Orthodox, so you should know. And my father was the vice president of the Sher Tefillah. And his name was Melford Goldman Oliver Shalom. And I know my father watches me today, and he's very proud to see that I'm giving back to the Jewish community.
Yes, first off, I want to thank Rabbi Kelman and Jax for having me here. It's a real pleasure. My name is Darren Sederoff. I'm a practicing criminal lawyer in Toronto and throughout the province. It's my job every day to represent people charged with criminal offenses, all types of criminal offenses, and it's my job to ensure that everyone gets a fair trial and that everyone's entitled to the presumption of innocence. Right now, I have clients charged with offenses from drug possession, shoplifting, assaults, kidnapping to murder. And tonight, I've been asked to speak about the legal ramifications and consequences of using and abusing drugs. As indicated, I go to court every single day and I see firsthand what using, selling, and abusing drugs and alcohol does to young people. I want to take the example today of marijuana possession, or we could talk about ecstasy possession. And I want to start from the beginning. I want to talk about what it's like when somebody gets charged and has to go through the court process for marijuana possession. First off, when someone gets charged with drug possession, the first thing that happens is they're arrested and detained. Now, what does it mean to be detained? It means that a police officer will take you, they'll hold you, they'll take you down to the local police station, they'll charge you officially with a drug offense. Once you're at the police division, what they'll do is they'll fingerprint you, then they'll take detailed photographs of your whole body. And then what happens is that the fingerprints, the photographs are then placed into a database for identification purposes. So then what happens is police can track you, they can keep an eye on you, and you're in this database forever. It's a demeaning process, and I've seen it hundreds of times, and it's meant to be demeaning. Now, many of you have heard, read, that marijuana possession is legal. That is false. For this speech, I have canvassed and spoke to many federal crown attorneys throughout the province that are in charge of prosecuting minor drug possessions. And my conclusion is that each territory deals with marijuana possession differently. I've been advised that the police can and will arrest you for minor drug possession. The law is still on the books. It's a very live issue. And still is not decided before the court. So I want to be clear here. The police can and will arrest you for smoking a joint. And then once again, once you're arrested and processed and fingerprinted and given a court date, then the courts deal with it very differently. It's dependent on the case-by-case basis. And then, as I indicated, there's a potential that you can get a criminal record for smoking a joint. Now, what does it mean to have a criminal record? First off, it's a personal and permanent impediment on your name. The record's attached to your name. It goes with you wherever you go. What this can do, it can prevent you from attaining your goals, from becoming a doctor, police officer, politician, veterinarian, probably not from becoming a lawyer, but who knows. So I just want to be clear to the audience. What a criminal record is, it's a real and very live recorded notation on your name. It can prevent you from traveling. It can prevent you from seeing the world. And it can have very dire immigration consequences if you're not a Canadian citizen. Now, in conclusion, I see it every day. The court's filled with young individuals charged with drug possessions and other offenses as a result of using, abusing drugs and alcohol. I see it every day, and I want to urge each and every one of you to enjoy your youth, but understand that some decisions carry with you for life, like it or not. I want to thank you for your time, and if anybody has any questions, I'll be here. Shalom, and thank you.
Who's got a good answer? How do you convince your kids you're once a teenager? Whenever I participate in any meetings, and people like Marlo and Jay stand up and speak about their experiences publicly, the best part of the evening, the best part of their comments is when they say, it's been 8 years, it's been 13 months, it's been 20 years, and everyone applauds. And that's really the best part of the evening. And unfortunately, over the past couple of years, we've also heard from people like Mr. Haywood a number of times. One too many times is too many times, and has to be an exceptionally difficult moment for parents like Mr. Haywood to share what happened a month ago or share what happened 15 years ago, because what may have happened 15 years ago, I'm sure for he and his family, it's as if it happened today, every single day. I want to thank Rabbi and Mrs. Kelman and Jax for inviting me, for hosting me today, and for all of you being here this evening. And I chose the topic, how do I convince my kids that I was once a teenager? For the obvious reason, because every single teenager tends to believe that his or her parent started at the age of 40. They were born at 40 years old or 50 years old. And there's at least one young man there, 13, 14 years old, that's smiling. So I hope so far I'm okay. My discussion this evening will be on prevention. My discussion this evening will be to focus on that hopefully we will never get into situations that any one of our children, of our friends' children, with all due respect to Jay, and I know Jay understands what I'm saying, that we would never have to be in a situation where any one of our children, our friends' children, or children's children will have to get up and make a speech like Jay. So my focus will be on prevention. And that you will never have to hire a criminal attorney to help get your kids from where the conversation went this evening. So we're focusing on prevention. Virtually everything I will say this evening, you know. There isn't going to be one word that I will speak about this evening that you haven't heard before, that you don't know, that your parents haven't told you, that your rav hasn't spoken about in shul, or that you haven't read or haven't heard. The only difference is, what I'm going to be speaking about is so simple that most of us tend not to do the simplest things in life, because we tend to overlook the simplest things because they're so easy, we'll say we'll take care of them another day. So I'm going to focus on some very simple issues. Let me outline four key points I'm going to be discussing this evening. Most parents that we see at Ohel in our treatment programs for substance abuse or for any word related to abuse, whether we're speaking about drugs or alcohol or gambling addictions or any other type of addictions, and I'm focusing on adolescents. I'm not speaking about adults. This evening I'm focusing on adolescents. I'm speaking about from the age of approximately 12 to 20. Everything I'm talking about is only for adolescents. Most parents don't know what their kid was involved in until it was too late. That's one point I'm going to be speaking about. The second point I'm going to be talking about is fencing. Fencing. What and how do we say to our kids? The third issue is how many people here have children or grandchildren below the age of 13? Wow. How many parents here have kids 12 and 13 years old? Okay. We're going to be speaking a lot about the age of 12 and 13. And the fourth topic I'm going to be speaking about is friends. Friends. So if anyone asks you, what did Mandel say tonight when you came to hear what he talked about, simply tell them Mandel spoke about fencing in my 13-year-old child. That's what Mandel talked about. Most often asked question is, are there more problems today? Are there more drugs today than there have been over the past couple of years? And the answer, in my opinion, is no. And I will contradict some of the other people that have spoken of some conventional wisdom. The answer is no. Shlomo HaMelech said in Koheleth, Ma shehaya hi shehaya, ma shenasa hu shayasa, ve'en kol chadash tachas ha-shemesh. Shlomo HaMelech said, whatever has been is what will be. Whatever has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. So parents, yeshivas, rabbeim, have always been concerned about drugs. Just think about it in the following context. In the 50s, we had Elvis and everything associated with Elvis. In the 60s, we had Timothy Leary. In the 70s, we had the Vietnam counterculture. In the 80s, we had the Medellin drug cartel, the Medellin Cali drug cartels. We had the crack epidemic. In the 90s, we had the excesses. We began to feel, in part, greater freedom. And there was an introduction of drugs within the Jewish community. Drugs were always available to the Jewish community, but in the 90s, drugs became available within the Jewish community. We'll speak about it in a minute, how drugs began to be brought in by Jewish drug dealers in very significant ways for the first time. And in the year 2000, in the decade 2000, unfortunately, it will be known as the decade that revolutionized gay marriages. And there are some parallels to the drug issue, which we'll talk about. What's good is we're speaking more openly today. We have seminars like this. Rabbanim are speaking about it. These type of seminars are not only occurring with parent groups, but they're occurring in yeshivas, not only in the more modern yeshivas, but they're occurring also in, for lack of labeling, the more right-wing yeshivas. Rabbanim are speaking about it from the pulpit. There are more professionals within the community that can provide drug treatment. That's good. What's bad is that it's much easier to buy drugs within our community. You don't have to go over there to buy the drugs. As I think it was Jay that mentioned it, I'm not sure, Mr. Sederer mentioned it, that you can buy it within the yeshivas. What's also bad is that booze is so significantly available within our community that it, to a very large extent, is causing some alcoholism amongst 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. Now, the experiences that we have at Ohel are not in Canada. They're not in Toronto. But they're also not only in New York. The experiences that I'm recounting for you are everything that we've learned in doing our work in New York and also nationally. And I believe what I'm sharing with you tonight is not only the experiences of Ohel, but also the experiences of our colleagues as we share information amongst many organizations, amongst many cities. So how do we convince our kids that we understand, that we know, that we were once a teenager? Let's use a simple example of fashion. You know, today, the fashion is single-breasted three-button suits, narrow lapels, pointed shirt collars, narrow ties, ventless pants, bulky shoes. Kids today want to wear what my parents and what my grandparents were wearing. If Britney Spears and Tom Cruise were wearing these clothings, that's what these 12, 13, and 14-year-old kids want to wear. But if that same clothing was put in a Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva was modeling it, there's no way the kids would want to wear it. But exactly what the Rosh Yeshivas are wearing today, what the Rebbeim are wearing today, is what's hot in the fashion magazines, if you consider it, if you think about it. So if you talk to your kids about that, you know, Saba was wearing, Grandpa was wearing the same single-breasted suit that you're looking to buy, I'm not sure that they would want to buy it. But how do you connect with them that you know what's going on in this world, that there is nothing new under the sun? So the question is for the kids, who are the role models? A tremendous amount of pressure is put on kids to succeed. Not everyone can be the best. I'd like to point out to you what I consider to be the absolute best work and the thinnest work on raising children. Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, a very prominent speaker in Eretz Israel, Planting and Building, Raising a Jewish Child. Rabbi Wolbe emphasizes that Chanoch L'Nar Al Pi Darko, teach a child according to his way, is don't teach him beyond his limits. Rabbi Wolbe talks about that the average is okay. It is okay to raise an average child. That it is okay to come home with averaged grades. That it is virtually impossible for every single child to excel. Somebody has to get an 80. Somebody has to get an 86. Every single child in the class can't get a 94. But we put a tremendous amount of pressure on our kids to excel.